I'm going to be mentioning this later, but Metta truly is the mother of all the Brahma-viharas. And I've noticed in many of these Buddhist lists, of which there are zillions, there almost seems to be a hierarchy of what needs to come in what order. Like the training precepts, the first precept, I will not harm or kill living beings, and everything underneath it is just a different aspect of that precept. And with metta is the first of the Brahma-viharas, boundless friendliness, loving kindness to all sentient beings. And then underneath it comes karuna, compassion, where it is really alleviating the suffering of other people or animals or other living beings. And then next comes mudita, where we actively enjoy the joy and happiness of other living beings. And then equanimity, as Dennis said last night, is the balance, understanding that life has its ebbs and flows, and we're not going to sink or become too exuberant over either. We're going to be okay with as life unfolds. So metta is also a concentration practice. I know when I first heard this, I was a little surprised, because we think of the breath and staying with the breath, and if I can only stay with the breath, I'm going to become very concentrated, and I'll have these wonderful jhanic states. I know it'll happen for me. And then reading that it also is something that takes place with metta. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but the five aspects of concentration are also available in metta, where you have the initial application, which will be either a mantra or a visual or a heartfelt sense of a being in your heart, where your heart opens. And that keeps expanding into a feeling of joy and happiness. And then you actually become one with that feeling. There's no need to go anywhere, do anything else, just being with that. And that's in a concentrated state. So as I said, I'm going to give you a very brief history of metta, because I just finished reading a book on early Buddhist women, which was very interesting, where they talked about metta. And metta originally came, and we still know comes from the mother figure. And the word metta actually comes from the word mita as Kalyana mita, so friend. And it means dear friend. Originally, there was in India what is called the cult of the mother. And the cult of the mother prescribed what women should be doing in India before the Buddha's time and in the Buddha's time, and also held it up as a mental state that everybody should aspire for. So the dharma of women at that time, to fulfill the dharma, was to have 10 sons. You were doing pretty good if you had 10 sons. You had fulfilled your obligations. Women who went off as ascetics or didn't want children were held in very high suspicion. Something was wrong here. You can see what the Buddha was fighting against at the time when women wanted to join the Sangha. When women had children, they were then given a new name, and it was named after their children. And this is still going on today. It's a cultural imperative. Has anybody heard of Deepa Ma? A lot of you have. A contemporary Indian saint. Well, Deepa Ma means mother of Deepa, her daughter. So she received a new name after she had a child. So it was the highest goal of women to have these children and to love them. But on the other hand, their children would eventually leave them, and that would leave them in samsara. So at the time, women were held up as having this wonderful mental attitude and loving kindness towards their children, but once the children left, they were left in samsara, in just unhappiness, in with life's vicissitudes. So women at the time were considered somewhere between animal and human, because they could never be free, because they would have these children who would leave them. So the Buddha turned this around, and he said, we should be using this state of mind, this loving kindness, and perpetuate it, but not just towards one child, towards all living beings. And that's what he developed with his monks. Have any of you heard of the Theragata? It's the writings of the elder nuns, and it's a book in the Pali Canon. It's one of the older books, and it's really wonderful reading. These women just wrote exquisite verses on their awakening and getting away from these men who held them down, and they just couldn't wait to spend time practicing, and very, very thankful for the opportunity. I think there's about 35 women who are in the Theragata. 18 of them have lost children. So, you know, in Indian society, that would be, you're pretty useless. They had no children. And for many of them, coming to the Buddha's Sangha was their way of having a meaning in life. He gave their life meaning, saying you didn't have to just be a mother. You could be a mother to all sentient beings. So there was one that I was reading about who I especially like. And her name's Ubiri. And she had a daughter named Jiva who she loved tremendously. And Jiva died. Ubiri is one of the 18 women who lost children. And she came to the Buddha, you know, devastated. And this is what he said to her. Mother, you cry out, O Jiva, in the woods. Come to yourself, Ubiri. 84,000 daughters, all with the name Jiva, have burned in the funeral fire. For which one do you grieve? So this is stating very plainly. We all love all sentient beings. Everybody suffers. Everybody needs loving kindness. Everybody needs boundless friendliness. The Buddha, when he taught metta to his monks, it was the antidote to fear. And I'm sure many of you have heard the story. The Buddha asked the monks to go out into the forest and to meditate in the dark, scary forest. No lights. No fire, no nothing. Go out there and meditate. And they said, okay. But they weren't thrilled about it. And they went out there. And in the forest, there were devas. And they were tree devas. And they were not pleased that these men had come out into the middle of their forest. So they did all sorts of obnoxious things. They made foul odors, and they did shrieking sounds, and caused great fear in the monks. And the monks just turned around right back to the Sangha and told the Buddha, no way, we're not doing this. And he said, I'm going to teach you the best armor that you could have, and that's metta. And he taught them metta. And by the way, the phrase in metta where we say, as a mother cherishes her child, her only child, it used to be son, not child. I don't know when that was changed, but it was changed at some point. I did a self-retreat a few months ago, and I listened to a long talk actually it was a series of talks by Bhante Gunaratana, who's one of my favorite people and wrote that wonderful book, Eight Mindful Steps to Happiness. And he had a way of talking about metta, which was really, really helpful. And he said the original way the Buddha taught, and I'll go into this a little bit more, was radiating metta. Not the categories, which I'll go into in a minute, but just radiating metta. And he said the reason this is really a good thing is when you try to isolate who you want to send metta to, it really ruins your concentration. But to actually radiate metta to all living beings allows you to concentrate and to send loving kindness to everybody. So, before we can even, well, I forgot to mention near enemy and far enemy of metta. So, I have a problem using the word love with metta. And I'll tell you my problem is love in our society is so, I think, overused. And it has so many different meanings. You know, it can mean sexual love, it can be love of partner, it can be love of your dog, love of your children, love of your friends. They're all, you know, completely different. And with metta, we're supposed to even love the people who have harmed us. I'm not an awakened being, and I have trouble loving people who have harmed me. But what I have found is I can be friendly, and I can wish them well. I can do that. So I prefer the definition that Bhante Ji had used, boundless friendliness. I think, at least for me, and I'm speaking strictly from my own point of view, as Dennis said last night, we're all going to be talking about how we come upon this practice and how it works for us. But boundless friendliness works for me. So, before I get off the topic, the near enemy to metta is a passionate love, actually desire. You know, when you're in a relationship, you expect, I'm doing this for you, and you do this for me, and we've got a pact, and we've got a relationship. That is not boundless love or friendliness. It's a pact. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not what metta is. And if you think that is metta, you can get yourself in a whole lot of trouble and a lot of hurt. The far enemy of metta, what would be the opposite of boundless friendliness?
Ill will.
Exactly. Anger, ill will. That's right. And all those other emotions that jump off of anger, ill will, it could be fear, it could be guilt, aversion, all of those are the far enemy, the exact opposite, and metta is the antidote to many of them. So before we can even start metta, we generally need to do some forgiveness. And not all of us need to, but for many of us, we need to. And forgiveness practice is actually very, very, very simple. There's three categories of forgiveness practice. Forgiveness of others who have harmed us. Asking forgiveness of those we have harmed. And forgiving ourselves when we think we have failed ourselves. And you can use your own phrase, and this will probably come up at some point on this retreat, because it does. I know I had, not in this retreat so much, but on other retreats, things came up from 25 years ago, you know, of somebody I slighted. Where did that come from? But there it was. And all you can do is, I am sorry I did this to you. Please forgive me. And there's a real healing in just acknowledging it and saying it to yourself, not keeping it as, oh, that's not important, but actually acknowledging it. I read a really interesting quote from, I hope I'm pronouncing him right, Nisargadatta Maharaja. He's a Hindu saint, an Indian saint, and he wrote a book called I Am That. And he tells a wonderful story about a man who was really having problems with his mother. He didn't feel his mother loved him. He never had a good relationship with her. He didn't even feel she was particularly a good woman. And so he went to Nisargadatta and told him about this. And Nisargadatta said, you have to forgive her. And the young man said, she wouldn't let me forgive her. And he replied, she can't stop you. And that's what forgiveness does. We can do whatever we want with forgiveness. We can forgive and forgive, because who's healing? It's not the other person. It's for us. It's for us. I know I had a time when I had asked forgiveness from someone who I hurt somewhat knowingly and a lot unknowingly. And I asked forgiveness, and it was denied. But it was okay, because I was able, for that period of time, to let go of my ego and not, I've got to be right. I just wanted to be free of that. And it was okay. So be willing to look at forgiveness in that light. You want to start allowing yourself to live completely, to be fully human. And that means letting go of a lot of these notions that we have about ourselves and others. And the other comment I want to make about others and forgiving them is, we don't know anybody's story but our own. You know, people who have wronged us, who have done something that we don't consider kind to us, we don't know what they were going through. We don't know what their state of mind was. We don't know what happened. All we know is this very small segment of life that comes from our point of view. The Buddha said it's like looking at the sky through a straw. We don't see the whole picture. I love collecting stories on forgiveness and metta. I've got a bunch of them. I'm going to tell you my two favorite ones. You know I love telling stories. So, in fact, when I go through the paper, I read very little of it anymore. I scan it, looking for stories that are going to inspire me and that make my heart happy. And I also feel you should support your local newspaper, but that's another story. So the two that I really like, and those of you who have gone to SIM for a while have heard me tell both of these, so bear with me. One of them comes from the South African Truth Commission. And this story was shortly after apartheid was ended, and the South African Truth Commission came into being, and people were brought up in front of it not to be punished. The white races to continue the apartheid system were brought up, but they heard how much hurt had taken place, how much devastation, because people were killed, people were tortured in the name of apartheid. So in this one particular instance, an elderly black woman was there to face the man who had murdered both her son and her husband. And the judge said, what would you like to say to this man? And she said, well, you took away my family. I have nobody left. And what I really enjoyed about my family was my husband would take me to church on Sundays. and my son would come for his favorite meal during the week, and I have neither of those any longer. So I want you to be that person. You are going to take me to church on Sundays, and you are coming to my house for a home-cooked meal every week. That's your sentence. That's a true story. And that just, if that doesn't open your heart, I don't know what will. That, I just think that's what a saint that woman is, to be able to not pile on top of the suffering, the immense suffering she already had, but to forgive and actually offer metta to this man. The other one took place, I think about 10 years ago. We talked about it in Sangha, and it was in an Amish community, I believe in Pennsylvania, where a deranged gunman went to an Amish school and shot 4 school children. And I think they were all girls. And, it was just outrageous. These peaceful people, why on earth would this man go and shoot these children? Death penalty. He's got to suffer. This is awful. This is terrible stuff, which it was. What did the Amish families do? They went to his family with food and offers of help because they no longer had a breadwinner. They said, "We forgive you and we will support you." That's metta. That's forgiveness, and that's metta. What is more powerful than that? So when you think about forgiveness, try to remember these. I think most of us have much smaller issues than these, and yet these people managed to forgive. In prison, guilt is a huge issue, as you can imagine. And especially people who are in for life. I'm going to share this briefly with you too, and then I'll get on to more metta. Men in prison are very concerned about their karma. Somebody has murdered somebody else, done something, more often done something when they were 16 and 17, and now they're 50, and they're still suffering tremendously from guilt. I went to a retreat, 10 years ago now, and Ajahn Suchito, who is the abbot of Chithurst Monastery in England, and he travels to the U.S. about once a year, and if you ever get a chance, please go do a retreat with him. He is remarkable. And I had the opportunity to have a private interview with him, and I asked him, I said, "So these men are guilt-ridden, and they want to have a methodology for dealing with this guilt." Unfortunately, I couldn't print it out because I ran out of ink too, but I wrote it down to the best of my ability, what he said. And he said, "Guilt is a wasted emotion. Guilt leaves us mired, like in quicksand. We don't go anywhere. It's almost selfish. Remorse allows us to see the wrong that we've done and propels us towards action. This is taking control of one's karma. So admit completely the wrong that was done." Admit completely the wrong. And this can apply to any of us. You know, I was talking about prisoners, but admit it. That ego that is holding us with a certain stance, thinking this is the way life is, you got to let it go. Admit completely the wrong that was done. Understand the emotional component that was present. Know it intimately when the action that caused harm took place. Be able to recognize it all the time. So it could be jealousy, it could be anger, it could be fear. Knowing that emotional component so well that it is immediately an alarm when it comes up. I might succumb again to this action that caused harm. Replace the habitual reactivity of this emotional state with skillful physical and mental behavior. And this is like metta being the antidote for fear, for anger. Resolve to never again react in this harmful manner when the state arrives. And finally, forgive yourself, and if appropriate, seek the forgiveness of others. He said, this cleanses karma. So metta itself. So there's a number of ways of practicing metta in meditation, as I mentioned. The original way of practicing metta, what the Buddha taught, was radiating metta. Radiates in 10 directions, and there's chants and just beautiful sayings that go along with it. But essentially, it's just bringing a heartfelt sense of boundless friendliness or loving kindness, if you wish, as the Amish did, as that elderly black woman did, and let that radiate out to all living beings. This is usually the method that is used by people who have been practicing metta for a long time and have it as a concentration practice. It's been suggested that we not do this here. I brought this up 2 years ago. This time we're going to deal with the categories in a slightly different way, though. The category method was devised by Buddhaghosa in the Visuddhimagga 500 years after the Buddha died, and he tried to really come up with a system for everything that the Buddha said. Here's where all our lists come from. And he tried to come up with a methodology for metta, which is very, very effective, especially when you're starting a metta practice. There are 5 categories, and we offer metta to all of them, and they become increasingly more difficult as we work with them. We start with ourselves, and then we move to a benefactor, we move to a dear friend, we move to a neutral person, and then we move to what has traditionally been called the enemy, but contemporary-wise we say the difficult person. I'm going to talk a little bit, well, I'll be leading you in this meditation tomorrow, but I'm going to say this right now. I will be leading you from category to category. If you practice metta, you don't have to. You could stick with yourself. Sharon Salzberg tells a wonderful story about, in her book, Loving Kindness, which is a great book, by the way. It's one of my always have. And she said for a solid week at a retreat, she did metta for herself. That's it. Just for herself. Over and over again. May I be safe and protected from all types of harm and danger. May I be peaceful and happy. May I be healthy and strong. May I be free from suffering, or whatever phrase that you want to use. So she said this over and over. A week passed, and she said, I felt nothing. Nothing. Just irritated that nothing had taken place. And so she left the retreat and thought, well, that sucks. Nothing took place. I just wasted a week of my time. And she was at her house, and she was taking a jar or something out, and it broke. And it landed on the ground. It shattered. And she went, oh, you are so stupid. But I love you anyway. And she went, where did that come from? So I think this is important to remember, that just like everything. This is not going to be immediate. Sometimes you're not going to feel anything is happening at all. Yet it is. Just by your intention of wanting this to take place, to have an open heart, that's huge. Wanting to do metta itself is a great practice. No, there might not be bells and whistles, and you might not feel this, you know, enormous opening of the heart. And I'll go into that in a minute. But your intention, I want to send kindness to myself and other sentient beings. I want to do that. That intention is huge. Metta is also a wonderful everyday practice. I think what Dennis was talking about, the metta he tried to evoke towards the man who was cutting him off and driving dangerously. Even if you're not able, and again, I'll go back to loving that guy, which I think would be extremely difficult. Wishing him ease, I think, is much more doable. Yes, may you be safe. May you drive safely. May you get to where you're going without killing yourself or somebody else. Yes, we can do that. And how much is that going to alleviate in our own psyche by doing that instead of that SOB? You know, I'm going to catch up and I'm going to show him how much harm would come from that. So just letting go. And it, again, this is letting go of ego. It's not wanting to be right or wrong. It is letting go and just letting an open heart replace that ego, that it's got to be about me. I noticed, I was telling Dennis when we first got here, a couple days before we got here, I was frantic. I had just come back from New York City, and it was a lovely time, but had to get ready for this retreat, and was running out of time, and getting pretty frantic, and no clean clothes. And also, as a digression, I'm also the officiant at my son's wedding in 3 weeks, and the officiant at Roseanne de Fleming's funeral on October 4th. So all of these things and getting these talks together and clothes and everything, I was getting kind of frantic. And who comes up to my door but Jehovah's Witnesses. Of course. The timing couldn't be more perfect. And but here's what metta practice has done for me. 5 years ago, in fact, 5 years ago I did do this, I arrogantly said, you know, I am a Buddhist chaplain, and I don't need what you're selling. Something like that. I might not have been that crass, but pretty close to it. And it certainly was in my mind to be that crass, even if I was a little more polite. And this time I noticed immediately these women are doing what they think is best for other people. They are so kind. And it was kind of like Sharon Salzberg's, where did that come from? And one of them especially was an older woman. You could tell that she's having problems with her legs, big swollen ankles, on high heels, tottering around with a younger woman helping her. And I just felt tears. Oh, God, she's doing this because she believes she's helping other people. She's doing this out of the kindness of her heart. How could I have ever felt any antagonism toward these people? So that's what metta practice does. There was also an experiment at an elder care facility. Some of you might have heard about this one. And all the... not all of them. They had a group of people, and this group of people, they gave them plants that they were to take care of. Mm-hmm. However, half the group were told, just enjoy the plants. You don't have to do anything. You don't even have to water them. They will be fertilized by staff. They'll be taken care of. Just enjoy the plants. The second group was told, you are responsible for these plants. You have to fertilize them. You have to water them. You have to care for them. And after a year, they evaluated how these two groups were doing. And the group that had to care for the plants had longer longevity, had greater ease of being, greater happiness, just because they were caring for these plants rather than allowing somebody else to take care of them. So in meditation, I think when we do metta, the same as doing vipassana, we think something needs to happen. Something's got to happen. I'm sitting here doing this, just like Sharon Salzberg said, for a week I'm doing this. What? Nothing? Nothing? But something is happening. I guarantee it. I've said this so many times, and it's so true. This practice is cumulative. You don't think anything's happening. Do it anyway. Because you will be amazed. All of a sudden, one day, the mind is bright. You are not caught up in all the scenarios you used to be. And you start seeing the possibility of freedom. As I mentioned, intention is enough. I'll talk more about that tomorrow. We need to plant the seeds and then settle back and just let the seeds take care of themselves. It's like maybe some of you had read the story. I think it was a Dharma teacher when he was young, and it was a chrysalis, a cocoon, and a butterfly was starting to come out, and he was so anxious to see the butterfly that he broke open the chrysalis and destroyed the butterfly in the process. Everything comes into being on its own good time. As long as we do the work, we create the causes and conditions for it to happen, it'll happen. Okay, here's some really good stuff about metta. The benefits of metta. Some of these I can verify, some, well, not so much. Okay, you will sleep easily. You will wake easily. That would be a good one, especially for me since I'm doing the morning bell. You will have pleasant dreams. I can vouch for that one. Do metta and you will have pleasant dreams. People will love you, hopefully. Be nice. Now this one I'm not sure, it'd be nice. Devas and animals will love you. External dangers will not harm you. Now this could get you in trouble. So, you know, this is nice and I hopefully that's true, but don't test it. This is true. Your face will be radiant. Your mind will be serene, you will die unconfused, and you will be reborn in happy realms. So a lot of good stuff comes from practicing metta, the first of the Brahma Viharas. I'm going to finish with a little bit about metta for ourselves, because this is such a difficult topic for many of us, doing metta for ourselves. Especially in our society, first of all, we never think we're good enough. We never think that we're deserving of loving kindness. We don't. And this is such a mistake. I'm giving a talk on this in a couple of weeks, but it's actually called conceit. in Buddhist parlance, it is obsession with self. So when we can't give ourselves the same kind of loving kindness that we would give to anybody else, we're being selfish. We're being selfish. I know it doesn't sound like it makes sense, but to me, I think that's helpful. It makes it easier for me to give myself the same loving kindness I would wish on all other sentient beings. So, when we come to ourselves as a category, I know for many of us, we've been told to picture ourselves as a baby, you know, hold ourselves in our arms. I've always had trouble with that. I thought I was the only one. I heard a talk by Temple Smith who said he ran out of a retreat screaming because he just couldn't stand the thought of holding himself as a baby. He said it just wasn't there. And I can relate to that. However, what we can do, which I can appreciate, is we can think of something we have done that has been kind to someone else, a kind action. Every one of you, and probably many actions, have done something kind for someone. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Just where it evokes, yeah, I did that and it felt right. I was glad to be of help, to be of service. That's it. That's the seed. That's all you need. And you think of that as your starting point. I did this because I wanted kindness to take place, whatever that is. And this kindness could take place in body, speech, or mind, especially speech. The Buddha put so much emphasis on speech and talking kindly. Not harshly, not gossiping, not swearing. So when have you committed an act of kindness that you yourself appreciated yourself, that felt good, I'm glad I did that? That's all you have to do. And I'll go more into that tomorrow. So I think that, I know I probably forgot a million things because I was taking notes, but I think that wraps up my talk for tonight.